Washington and WPAI in New York. I'm Sue Goodwin.
Dark up and blue. Don't let us hang around this town and let what others say come true. We're just good for nothing, they all figure. A boy's grown up shiftless jitter. Now we can't hardly stand for that. Or is that really where it's at? We people who are darker than blue, we got no time for segregating. Let's talk about brown and yellow too.
Hi everybody, this is Jackie Lukeman and welcome to another episode of Darker Than Blue here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia area. I am so happy that you are joining me again for another Friday. It is Friday, January 24th, and today I am very glad to be talking about this topic. Well, maybe not glad. I think I'm just glad that we're finally at the point where, as we leftists say, the contradictions have heightened to the point that we can have the honest conversation about what the problems really are. But before we get into that, I want to let you know that there are so many ways you can listen to me, Jackie Lukeman, if you like what you hear on Darker Than Blue on Wednesday mornings and sometimes on Tuesday or Thursday from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. You can hear and see me on Black Liberation Media on YouTube. You can also support my writing and other work, History Rewind and regular talking points through Patreon at patreon.com/LukemanNation. That's LukemanNation. And I have started a Substack for my longer written articles, and you can check those out at Substack at Lukeman Nation. So let's get into what's on my mind today. As Trump begins his second presidency by issuing a series of sweeping executive orders that are certainly worrying for many and outright terrifying for even more, I do wonder what people are really afraid of, since the authoritarianism that they claim Trump is ushering in, well, y'all, it couldn't have been easy for him to carry out had the previous administration done anything to protect vulnerable people, or, if they hadn't engaged in the same or similar authoritarian behavior. Now, I know some people are already upset at me because I said that the previous administration, the Democrats, engaged in authoritarian behavior similar to what Trump is threatening, but I'm not kidding. This is not untrue. Let's look at the issue that's causing the most immediate concern right now, and that's probably the immigration orders Trump has just issued. Now, he's threatened to deport millions of people out of the U.S., including those who came here, quote unquote, legally under the Biden administration. And there is understandably a lot of outrage and fear as ICE and local police coordinate in some cities to start hunting people down. But do we remember that Biden deported the largest number of undocumented immigrants in nearly a decade, surpassing the record of Donald Trump's first term in office? Do we remember that? During Biden's tenure, he used the expanded emergency powers under the COVID protocols to conduct 4 million deportations. Trump carried out 1.9 million during his first term, and that they were both less than Obama. And Trump is certainly looking to outdo Biden's record because, you know, Trump is all about winning, right? But remember that Biden promised to pause deportations when he campaigned, and he promised again in 2021. But his administration ended up expanding deportations following this huge surge in border crossings. That was the excuse that the Biden administration used for their massive deportation scheme. But the surge in border crossings, well, that was caused by the imperialist interference from the Biden administration in the governments of global South countries like Ecuador and Peru, where right-wing governments were propped up with the support of the U.S. government under Biden, and those right-wing governments carried out brutal campaigns of repressions and massacres of indigenous people protesting them with the support and very often the aid of the Biden administration. Now, I'm confused, though, as to why people were not terrified of ICE deportations under Biden. I mean, I know people were. But the mass of people who are passing around these "I told you so" memes now about, oh, I told you how bad Trump would be. None of these people were talking about how bad Biden was in this area of immigration and deportation. But these people are now crippled with fear under the prospects of more of the same under Trump. Understand what Trump is claiming he wants to do is actually not new. Were Biden's deportations better? The 4 million deportations, was that better because Biden didn't announce that he was going to do them? What was it better that he deported that 4 million people because he didn't publicly direct ICE to do sweeps and roundups in major cities through an executive order like Trump is trying to do? Even as Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker vow to protect all residents regardless of residency or alleged legal status, and I say alleged legal status because there is no such thing as an illegal alien or an illegal immigrant, because human beings are not illegal and immigration is something people have been doing as long as people have existed. But, you know, like I said, people are posting these "I told you so" memes, saying that, you know, look, we told you to vote for the lesser evil and you didn't, so now you got the worse evil. But the worse evil is simply doing the same thing that your lesser evil candidates had already done at least 4 million times before. Neither party is less evil than the other. They are both evil. And if we only look at this issue of immigration, honestly, objectively looking at the material facts, we would come to that conclusion and disabuse ourselves of this idea of a lesser evil being a thing. But we have not, because we still fail to see the irony in chiding others for pointing out that Trump is only taking what Biden and Obama have done a step farther than they did. Now, I would think that 4 million people deported under Biden would be enough to spark outrage, but it largely did not, at least not outside of the anti-imperialist circles that I run in. So the people passing around these "I told you so" memes and comments today said little to nothing about Biden's deportations, nor did they say anything about the Biden administration's executive order in the first days of his administration that waived 26 federal laws to allow border wall construction in South Texas. Biden did that through executive order on his first few days in office. Even Kamala Harris, when she was campaigning, bragged about being tough on immigration, and even worse, she did the same thing, equating immigrants with drugs, gangs, and violence that Trump did, that everybody was all up in arms about. And they should have been. But let's be clear that when Harris said, quote, "The issue of border security is not a new issue to me. I was attorney general of a border state for 2 terms. I saw the violence and chaos that transnational criminal organizations cause and the heartbreak and loss from the spread of their illicit drugs." This is Kamala Harris campaigning on the issue of grim immigration, equating immigrants with transnational gangs, drugs, and violence. How is what she said different than what Trump said about immigrants eating people's pets? Or what he said in his first term when he spoke of immigrants, when he said, remember, they're not sending their best. They're sending rapists. They're sending gangs. They're sending drugs. Didn't she just use more words to say the same thing Trump said during his first term? Maybe if people listen to us anti-imperialist leftists, when we demonstrated against held teach-ins about educated people on know your rights policies, on how to respond to ICE knocking on your door under Biden, we did. We were out there in the streets. We were conducting these trainings. We were helping people learn how to protect their neighbors and families and friends. We were helping immigrant communities know their rights under Biden. And if people had paid attention to us and joined us, listened to us, believed us, and joined us then, maybe so many would not be scrambling now and in a panic trying to respond to Trump. But more importantly, for me anyway, maybe if Democrat policies actually protected people's right to migrate and ended the reasons people are forced to leave their countries in droves in the first place, and that is U.S. government interference and destabilization in their governments, maybe Trump would not have such an easy time continuing the same policies that every administration has carried out year after year. Then there's this other issue, this claims of rising fascism under Trump. And the latest example that has sparked outrage is Elon Musk's Nazi-esque salute. Now, I'm not going to get into the weeds of whether it was a full or a half or a quarter Nazi salute, because the real issue for me is, why are people outraged about that? But they didn't blink an eye when the Biden administration hosted Volodymyr Zelensky, president of Ukraine, a country that has a long history of supporting fascist movements. I mean, they were allies of Nazi Germany. They carried out pogroms and massacres of Jews and other targets of Nazi oppression, including Russians. They had a widely reported problem with fascist elements throughout the country. Ukraine did. It was so bad that in 2014, Reuters and most major U.S. and Western media outlets reported that while they utterly dismissed Russia's characterization of the coup in 2014 as a fascist junta, that is literally what Putin said about that coup in 2014, a fascist junta aiming to wipe out Jews and ethnic Russians in the east of the country, The Western media outlet said that statement was ridiculous, but often in the same articles like Reuters did, they also pointed out that the prevalence of fascist groups in Ukraine has been underplayed by the Ukrainian government and by many in the U.S. government. Reuters said that Ukraine had underplayed the presence and role of fascists in the country and pointed out the prevalence of groups like the Azov Battalion in the military and in the police. Now, if you remember, we anti-imperialist leftists told you that the 2018 civil war on the eastern region of the country, you know, where the ethnic Russian population mostly resides in Ukraine, was a result of this U.S.-backed coup that enabled and empowered those fascists. And since then, the U.S.-backed puppets in Ukraine have legitimized more fascist elements in the government, and under Zelensky acting as US, EU, NATO's proxy against Russia, he has eliminated freedom of press, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. That man has literally closed down Russian Orthodox churches. And he's carried out this repression in that country. Why didn't anybody believe us when we told you that all of that was fascism? We did tell you repeatedly. Oh, but what happened was you called us Putin's puppets. Yeah. So basically, it didn't matter to a lot of people who heard us explain what was going on in Ukraine as rising fascism enabled by U.S. government policy, enabled by John McCain and Victoria Nuland giving out cookies and standing on stage shaking hands with the fascists. It didn't matter to way too many people that Biden and Harris welcomed a fascist sympathizer, Volodymyr Zelensky, which makes Biden a fascist. I mean, if you sympathize with people who do evil things, guess what that makes you? It didn't matter to people that Biden and Harris invited Zelensky to the White House. But the same people seem to be suddenly upset at Elon Musk's comic book expression of fascism. Make this make sense, folks, because it doesn't to me. But of course, Democrats really can't dismiss a leader of another country that suppressed the rights of speech and the press and religion, because Democrats have crushed dissent against Israel and the genocide in Gaza. Who has been able to freely call the genocide what it is? To call Israel the fascist apartheid state that it is? And to call the Biden administration the fascist enabling, genocide enabling puppet master that it was, without being brutalized by police at protests, fired from our jobs, expelled from our schools and organizations, having our media and our social media pages and outlets shut down, aid groups designated as agents of terrorism, all for telling the truth about the Democrats facilitating genocide for fascist Zionists. Because you do know that Zionism is a white supremacist fascist ideology, right? And those of us who told you the truth about Ukraine were also silenced, repressed, and punished. The same with Syria, the same with the Sahel. I, folks, do not understand how people who were unmoved by the Biden administration giving bombs to the fascist apartheid state of Israel to bomb women, children, burn hospital patients alive in their tents, but the same folks silent about that are freaking out about an arm gesture by Elon Musk screaming about, look at Trump's friends being openly fascist. Facilitating genocide isn't openly fascist? You cannot be serious. And for the record, Germany taking Elon Musk's image and name off of public buildings and whatever his name is on throughout Germany, it means nothing. It means little to nothing when they too, the German government, not the people, but the German government, were silent on another genocide for the last 15 months. Germany has little moral authority these days either. People are talking about how we are moving into an era of authoritarianism in US government and the democracy is in decline. Really? Was it democracy when the Biden FBI prosecuted the Uhuru 3 on flimsy claims of them being foreign agents for Russia? Was it democracy when environmental activist Tortuguita was shot to death by local and state police in Georgia as he sat on the ground in front of his tent as part of the effort to protect the forest in a working class and poor black neighborhood in Atlanta from being razed to build Atlanta's infamous cop city? Was it democracy when none of the cops who participated in that man's murder were punished? Was it democracy when 60 Stop Cop City protesters were charged under the Biden FBI with RICO charges for protesting the Stop Cop City project? This is all under the Biden administration. What exactly do people think Trump will do that will be more authoritarian than what we have already seen and experienced under the Biden administration, at least doing to those of us who dissent? Because I recognize that most people don't care about what the Biden administration did because most people didn't dissent to what the Biden administration did. So I guess that the better question is, why do people not consider the way Biden-Harris treated the people standing up to them as authoritarian? Do people really like being brutalized and oppressed by Democrats better? Because honestly, that's kind of what it looks like. Y'all kind of looking like you like that Democrat oppression. You don't like the Republican oppression. You'd rather have the Democrat oppression. That's what it looks like. And what's worse is that Democrats were so busy proving or trying to prove to conservative voters that they could be just as tough on us troublemakers as they, the conservatives, could be and certainly wanted to be, that they left the door wide open for someone like Trump to come in and literally show them up. Why should Trump have been the one to declassify the FBI files on MLK, the assassination of MLK and JFK and others? Why should Trump have done that? Shouldn't the Democrats have been concerned with truth and transparency? Shouldn't they have been the ones to have done it? Why should Trump have been the one to facilitate a ceasefire? Although we know that Israel was never going to abide by it, but still, Trump made the call. Why didn't Biden do it? Why didn't Harris do it? Harris said when she was campaigning, we're working tirelessly toward a ceasefire. Well, Trump wasn't working tirelessly. He literally picked up the phone and made a call and had a conversation. You mean to tell me that Biden couldn't? Of course he could have. We know he could have because Reagan did it once. And Reagan was absolutely the devil. So if you cannot do better than what the devil does, what does that say about you? And please don't think I am giving Trump any credit or even saying that he is a good guy. No, I am saying that if Biden and Harris or even Harris Waltz had done what Trump did, we wouldn't be confused about whether Trump is a good guy or not, because he wouldn't have had the opportunity to do what the Democrats didn't. But Trump is an opportunist, and he seizes every chance he gets to throw egg on his enemies' faces and to make him look good. Trump doesn't care about Palestinians. He doesn't care about Gaza. He does not believe that that land is theirs. He doesn't care whether they go home or not. He doesn't care. He did this for his own personal purposes so that he could look very, very good in the eyes of voters. And in a way, I think that this was also Trump appealing to some of those liberal forces who were concerned about the genocide, but didn't want to speak up because they didn't want to rock the boat. Now Trump looks like a human being, and people should be looking at Biden as if to say, what was it that he had that he was able to do this and you, the president of the United States, seemed unable to? Or was it that you were simply unwilling? Do you see, Trump is doing this to make, partially, I believe. He also did this, I believe, to make the Democrats look bad, to make Biden and Harris look bad. He is not an unintelligent man. I'm not saying Trump is a genius. I'm saying he's sly like a fox. He's crafty. He's good at media manipulation. He's done it his whole life. But honestly, regardless of what Trump is or is not, regardless of whether he means it or not, whatever, if Democrats had done anything about these things and anything else that people had been demanding of them the last 4 years and during the previous 8-year Democrat administration under Obama, Trump would not have had the chance to show the Democrats up in these areas. And anti-imperialist organizers have been warning about the capitulation of the Democrat Party to the dictatorship of finance capital and their collusion with the Republicans to continue to prop up the system of governance that benefits them over the rights and needs of the people. Even in the area of campaigning, Democrats are spineless in that Trump, signing all of these sweeping and sweepingly awful executive orders in his first days, in this new term, is really just him appearing to his base to keep his campaign promises. I think we do take Trump at his word, no matter what crazy thing he says, and believe that he will try to do what he says. But I think he also knows full well that he might not be able to get everything that he says he wants to do done. I mean, Trump, okay, he may not be a genius, but I'm pretty sure he knows that he just can't issue an executive order and change the Constitution. You need a full constitutional convention for that. He knows he will be challenged in court on a lot of these things that he's issuing executive orders on. And some he knows are simply grist for his red meat hungry mill of supporters because he knows he's going to lose some of those court challenges. But if Democrats had actually governed to protect the people that these issues affect, that Trump is now attacking, it would not be so easy for him to attack them at all. Never mind that the optics of this are just a mess. They're just disastrous for the Democrats. Here Trump is signing these evil executive orders and declaring things like, see, I said I would do it, and here it is, holding up the executive order with his big old cartoon signature, while Biden did nothing of the sort for anything we wanted. No, not even that student loan foolishness. Because honestly, you all, if the government forgave those PPP loans, it could have forgiven student loans, but somehow the very smart career politician Joe Biden couldn't figure out how to get that done. I don't believe that for a second. I never have, and you shouldn't. If you did believe it, you should stop believing it now. There is nothing that could have really stopped the government from forgiving those student loans. Listen. I'm not trying to shame people for being afraid or beat people over the head for feeling like this is an emergency. It is an emergency, but it's not an emergency because of Trump. Trump is not the emergency. We are in a national crisis because there is no opposition party to the GOP. Both parties serve monopoly finance capital. Both parties are imperialist. Both parties are authoritarian. And this is a crisis that was inevitable. In a country where democracy is a nice idea on some old parchment, but is not a principle that is rigorously defended by either party. The truth is, it's just that one party has more palatable, socially responsible, and on-trend marketing of its authoritarianism, and the other is the big orange bull in a China shop kind of authoritarianism. If we had been honest about Democrat authoritarianism before now, maybe we would have been stronger to stop them before we had to deal with Trump 2.0. But honestly, folks, that's not what the Democrats wanted. They wanted Trump 2.0. They needed Trump 2.0 because they cannot win in 2028 without Trump 2.0. So my question for you, dear listeners, is the ball is in your court. It's up to you now. What are you going to do about it? Let's take a little time for a quick station break, and we'll be right back on Darker Than Blue here on WPFW 89.3 FM in the Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia area. We shall return.
On Saturday, January 25th at 2 o'clock p.m. at the Anacostia Library, a community meeting to plan activities in commemoration of the 30th anniversary of the Million Man March. That's Saturday, January 25th at 2 p.m. at the Anacostia Library, 1600 Marion Barry Avenue, Southeast.
Climate Friday host Reverend Lennox Yearwood Jr. is but one of the black voices in climate and environmental justice that will be featured at this year's Taking Nature Black Conference, March 5th through the 8th. Presented by Nature Forward and themed Reclamation and Resilience, with both online and in-person participation for connection, knowledge, inspiration, and more. Details about Taking Nature Black Conference at natureforward.org/takingnatureblack, all one word, Taking Nature Black. That's Taking Nature Black, Reclamation and Resilience, March 5th through the 8th. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Everybody, this is Jacqueline Loopman, and welcome to another episode of History Rewind in Loopman Nation. And we are on January week 3, so let's get going. Let's start with January 13, 1777, when abolitionist Prince Hall and seven other African Americans presented a petition for freedom to the Massachusetts Council and the House of Representatives. It began, the petition, this way: to the Honorable Council and House of Representatives for the State of Massachusetts Bay, in General Court, assembled January 13, 1777, the petition of a great number of blacks detained in a state of slavery in the bowels of a free and Christian country humbly showeth that your petitioners apprehend that they have in common with all other men a natural and unalienable right to that freedom which the great parent of the universe, that's God, hath bestowed equally on all mankind, and which they have never forfeited by any compact or agreement whatsoever. But that they were unjustly dragged by the hand of cruel power from their dearest friends, and some of them even torn from the embraces of their tender parents. He's talking about the trafficking of African children into enslavement from a populous, pleasant, and beautiful country, that's Africa, and in violation of laws of nature and of nations, and in defiance of all the tender feelings of humanity, brought here either to be sold like beasts of burden and like them condemned to slavery for life. There were other petitions and appeals to the courts, such as the one described in the children's book about Mumbet, and I encourage you to find that book about Mumbet, and the spelling of that is M-U-M-B-E-T. Please look it up. These were among the countless daily examples of the resistance by people who were enslaved to the institution of slavery, which goes to show this Prince Hall, a petition, goes to show that we understood, our ancestors understood that they came from Africa. They understood the evil that slavery was. They did not want to be enslaved. There were no happy slaves. And our ancestors who were enslaved resisted that enslavement in more ways than could have probably ever been documented, but I'm glad that we have this documentation of this particular form of resistance from Prince Hall. And you should recognize his name if you have family members who are older and probably in the South or on the Mid-Atlantic in particular, because Prince Hall is the founder of the Prince Hall Mason branch of the Freemasons, because the Freemasons were segregated. They refused to allow Blacks to join, so he made his own lodge. And Prince Hall Masons is the oldest and largest African-American fraternity in the United States, having been founded in 1784 by Prince Hall. Let's go on to the next submission. On January 14, 1868, the South Carolina Constitutional Convention met in Charleston with a majority of Black delegates. As described by the Digital South Carolina Encyclopedia, the 1868 Constitution was revolutionary because it embodied many democratic principles absent from previous constitutions. The new document provided for population alone, rather than for wealth or the combination of wealth and population as the basis for House representation. It also continued popular election of the governor. Additionally, the 1868 Constitution abolished debtors' prison, provided for public education, abolished property ownership as qualification for office holding, granted some rights to women, and created counties. Provisions in schools for the deaf and blind were also ordered in the Constitution. Race was abolished as a limit on male suffrage. The Black codes that had flourished under the Constitution of 1865 were overturned. There was no provision against interracial marriage, and all public schools were open to all races. This was one of the Reconstruction era constitutional conventions. Adam Sanchez writes in The Other 68, Black Power During Reconstruction, we talked about his book a couple of days before, he says, in South Carolina, the only state where Blacks made up a majority of the delegates, the convention passed a resolution asking Congress to lend the state $1 million to buy land for poor whites and Blacks. When Congress rejected the proposal, the first South Carolina legislature under the new constitution passed a homestead law to aid poor farmers and shifted the tax burden to large plantation owners. Gee, doesn't that sound a lot like tax the rich? Guess who didn't come up with it? Guess who came up with it first? At a time when even most northern states restricted the franchise voting to white men, every convention extended suffrage to Black men, and a few delegates like W.J. Ripper in South Carolina and Thomas Bain in Virginia pushed to extend the franchise to women as well. Several conventions expanded women's property rights and in South Carolina legalized divorce. Now, this is another example of formerly enslaved people providing the foundation for progressivism in the United States, in the political arena, equality and justice under the law, eliminating race and class oppression. So the idea that Black people don't understand class oppression and that we only focus on race oppression is ahistorical, and the Reconstruction documents prove that we have always understood that they are connected, and it was us who created progressivism. Let's move on. And let's move on to the next submission, and that's on January 15, 1817, when nearly 3,000 African-American men met at the Bethel AME Church, popularly known as Mother Bethel AME, in Philadelphia, and denounced the American Colonization Society's plan to resettle free Blacks in West Africa. Now, these men were summoned to this church to meet with the ACS and someone else that was engaged in this effort to carry out this plan to resettle free Blacks on the west coast of Africa. The genesis of this remarkable meeting can be found in the early efforts of Captain Paul Cuffee, a wealthy Black New Bedford ship owner. After an 1811 visit to the British colony of Sierra Leone, which had been established to receive free Blacks and later re-captives who were Blacks freed by the British Navy from slaving vessels taking them from Africa to the New World, Cuffee envisioned a similar colony for African Americans somewhere in West Africa. To promote his vision, Cuffee, at great financial loss, brought 38 Black volunteer settlers from the United States to Sierra Leone in 1815. And when he returned to the United States with news of the resettlement, he persuaded many of the most influential Black leaders of the era to support him in transporting larger numbers of African Americans to a yet-to-be-determined colony on the West African coast. The most important African American leaders in the United States at the time, Reverend Peter Williams of New York, Reverend Daniel Coker in Baltimore, and James Fortin, Bishop Richard Allen, and Reverend Absalom Jones, all of Philadelphia, they enthusiastically endorsed the plan. And they did so because of the dire nature of the situation that free Blacks faced in the North during that era. The vote was denied to all but a handful of Black men. No Black women could vote at the time. Black workers were limited in the occupations they could pursue and the wages they could receive. In Philadelphia, New York, Boston, and other northern cities, they were subjected to attack by white mobs and to the ever-present threat of slave catchers who kidnapped fugitive slaves and, on occasion, those who had never been enslaved. So to many leaders in the so-called free North, colonization to West Africa, where most of our people were taken from, seemed like an attractive option given their present alternative. At the same time, Cuffee was recruiting Black leaders to endorse his resettlement scheme. Reverend Robert Finney, the white minister of the Presbyterian Church of Basking Ridge, New Jersey, began what appeared to be a parallel plan for African-American colonization in West Africa. The difference was he enlisted the support of prominent white politicians, including President James Madison. In December of 1816, Finley also brought together numerous other white public officials and leading ministers and important businessmen to the Davis Hotel in Washington, D.C. to create the American Society for Colonizing the Free People of Color in the United States. The organization soon became popularly known as the American Colonization Society, or the ACS. With Bushrod Washington, the nephew of President George Washington, as its first president, the list of vice presidents of the ACS included Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, yes, that Daniel Webster of the dictionary fame, John Randolph, Francis Scott Key, yes, that Francis Scott Key, and General Andrew Indian Killer Jackson. Both the Cuffee Group and the ACS believed free American Blacks should settle in West Africa. There, however, their similarities and agreements ended. Cuffee and his supporters hoped that free Blacks and eventually enslaved Blacks would go to a yet-to-be-determined African colony and thus begin the process of emptying the U.S. of its Black population. Both enslaved and free, Cuffee wanted all Black people to leave the United States, even those who were enslaved, and go literally back home. The ACS, however, was clear from its founding that its efforts would include only free Blacks. There would be no interference with the institution of slavery, considering that most of the prominent supporters of the ACS were themselves slaveholders. This was hardly surprising. As the ACS viewed the situation, free Blacks were a dangerous element who could potentially incite enslaved people to rebellion. So removing free Blacks from the United States would strengthen the institution of slavery to continue the profits of those white slaveholders, some of whom were the vice presidents of the ACS. In January 1817, Bishop Allen and other Black leaders who had endorsed the ACS called the meeting in Bethel AME Church. Some 3,000 Black men, virtually the entire Black male population of Philadelphia, gathered to hear about colonization. The Black leaders expected the African-American men of the city to endorse the ACS and Cuffy colonization schemes, but what they got instead was a denunciation of the plan entirely. Apparently, the Black men feared that all free Blacks would be compelled, forced to go to Africa, especially those in slaveholding states. They saw correctly, as it turns out, that the ACS scheme allowed slaveholders to get rid of free Blacks. The January 1817 gathering of African American men became more than a major African American protest meeting on U.S. soil. It is an early example of what a people can accomplish when they are so united, determined, and fearless that they are willing to challenge their adversaries who hold all of the power and their own traditional leadership, who seem not to pay any attention to the separate agenda that the people they were in league with had. In one loud voice, the Black men of 1817 foiled a slaveholder scheme supported by a semi-government organization to exile them from what they saw as their land of birth. Their unanimous vote also sent a clear message to their own leaders that they stood resolutely, not necessarily with the country America, but with their loved ones still in chains, not with the slaveholders. These Black Philadelphians of 1817 also publicly declared their claim on the United States. As far as they were concerned, this was their land as well. They recalled that many of their kinsmen were among the 6,800 men who had fought and died in its revolution on the Patriot side, but also an even larger number had been killed fighting with the British, who, I must mention, the British offered Africans freedom if they would come and fight for them. The so-called Patriots of the United States offered Africans who fought for the Patriot side nothing. Those Black men on each side fought not for independence or the continuation of empire, but for the principle of freedom in the abstract, and as importantly, for their own physical liberation. On to the next submission. January 16, 1865, demands by Black ministers after the Ebenezer Creek Massacre led to the short-lived land distribution during Reconstruction known as Special Field Order Number 15, better known as 40 Acres and a Mule. This order declared that the confiscated land on the coastline from Charleston, South Carolina to Jacksonville, Florida, be redistributed to people freed from slavery in 40-acre parcels. Here's an excerpt of the actual order. At Beaufort, Hilton Head, Savannah, Fernandina, St. Augustine, and Jacksonville, the Blacks may remain in their chosen or accustomed vocations, but on the islands and in the settlements hereafter to be established, no white person whatsoever, unless military officers and soldiers detailed for duty, will be permitted to reside, and the sole and exclusive management of affairs will be left to the freed people themselves, subject only to the United States military authority and the acts of Congress. Within 6 months, 40,000 people who had been enslaved lived on 400,000 acres of coastal land. They used their skills and labor to make the land productive. They also set up their own civic and educational institutions. They established their own militia to protect themselves from the Klan. And in the PBS documentary, Reconstruction, the Second Civil War, historian Russell Duncan says this. So you've got this tiny little island, 12 miles long, 3 miles wide, and a government set up to resemble the United States government with a Supreme Court at the top. It's wonderful, beautiful, experiment in democracy, and people took to it very well. They liked the idea of having the power to select their leaders and remove them. Sadly, the field order was short-lived. As explained by BlackPast.com, less than a year after Sherman's order, President Andrew Indian Killer Johnson intervened and ordered that the vast majority of confiscated land be returned to its former owners, who abandoned the land during the Civil War in the first place. That's why it was confiscated. This included most of the land that the freedmen had settled and developed. The federal government dispossessed tens of thousands of Black landowners. In Georgia and South Carolina, some Blacks fought back, driving away former owners with guns. And when that happened, federal troops sometimes evicted Blacks by force. Now, if we were truly seen as fellow Americans and fellow citizens, this order would have been honored. Or if it were not honored, it would have been reinstituted by someone who recognized the injustice in rescinding it represented. But it was not, and it never has been. And as a matter of fact, the remaining descendants of those formerly enslaved people who settled that land along the coast in South Carolina, they are called the Gullah Geechee people. And that land has now been almost completely taken over by corporate hotel entities like Hilton, Marriott, Wyndham. And the locals, the descendants of those enslaved who tilled and cultivated and developed that land after their enslavement ended because of their struggle, they are no longer allowed access to the beach that was theirs. Let's move on to the next entry, which is January 17, 1893, when Queen Lili Uokalani of the independent kingdom of Hawaii was overthrown as she was arrested at gunpoint by United States Marines. American businessmen, particularly sugar plantation owners, led by Lauren Thurston, had supported annexation of the Hawaiian Islands to the United States. The Queen had been working on a new constitution that would restore voting rights that were denied back to Native Hawaiians. A new provisional government was installed with Stanford B. Dole as president. That name ought to sound very familiar, especially if you like bananas and pineapple. The troops had landed the day before, providing support, quote, to protect American lives and property. In today's language, that usually sounds like we are in this country to protect American interests. In 1898, President William McKinley signed a joint resolution of Congress authorizing the annexation of the Hawaiian Islands to the United States government. U.S. businesses greed for the resources they could steal and exploit in other countries is not a new phenomenon. It is the basis for all U.S. imperialist conquest around the world, always led by American businessmen and their interests for their profit at the expense of the native populations of whatever country those businessmen wanted resources from. War for oil? That's not new. It built this avaricious black hole of a country, even if the resource that was pursued at first was sugar, tea, or fruit. Let's move on to the next installment. January 17, 1961, when democratically elected Prime Minister of the Republic of the Congo, Patrice Lumumba, was executed with the assistance of the governments of Belgium and, guess who? The United States. In his 1960 Independence Day speech, Lumumba said, "We are going to show the world what the black man and woman can do when he works in freedom, and we are going to make of the Congo the center of the sun's radius for all of Africa. We are going to keep watch over the lands of our country so that they truly profit her children." Just 6 months later, he was in prison and executed by firing squad. Here is an excellent excerpt from a Zen Education Project lesson for high school classes on the Congo. The text that they include for the role of Lumumba in this lesson, explaining his importance in the history of the Congo and explaining why he was assassinated, is fascinating and very, very important to learn. Here it is. "I was the first elected prime minister of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I was a postal clerk and traveling salesman. In 1958, I helped found the Mouvement National Congolais, a political party that demanded independence from Belgium. In October 1959, I was arrested and imprisoned for inciting anti-colonial riots. I won the country's first parliamentary election in June of 1960. On June 30, 1960, King Baudouin of Belgium came to grant us our independence. How arrogant! His speech was even worse. He told us that we should be thankful the Belgians brought us civilization. In my speech, I reminded him of all the crimes they committed against us. As you can imagine, he thought I was ungrateful. White kings get upset when black men talk back to them. Predictably, the United States and Great Britain were also angry. They accused me of being a communist because I believed that the wealth of the Congo should remain in the Congo to create a strong society. The US CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, and their counterparts in Britain and Belgium paid a group of Congolese men, including Joseph Mobutu, to kill me. I was executed by a firing squad on January 17, 1961, after a long torture session. Before they killed me, they made me eat the paper on which my Independence Day speech was written. After my assassination, people all over the world protested the destruction of our democracy." Connecting back to Paul Cuffey, the ACS, and the refusal of free blacks to colonize West Africa, we need to be clear that being born in the United States does not make us American. We are a people from Africa. By the way, the electronic devices you are watching or listening to me on right now are created by mining of coltan in Congo through forced labor of entire families, but mostly children. That is because of the assassination of Patrice Lumumba and the continued destabilization and neo-colonization of the Congo by the U.S. and its Western corporate business capitalist interests like Apple, Dell, Microsoft, GE, etc. Let's move on to the next installment, which is on January 18, 1943, when Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto organized armed self defense units to oppose deportation to forced labor camps and to the Treblinka extermination camp. This was the first and largest Jewish urban uprising in German-occupied Europe, which sparked other ghetto EPWA uprisings, including the April-May Warsaw ghetto uprising. As David Rovics explains in his song, I Remember Warsaw, he said, people said we had no chances, but then we all knew they were right.